All right. So, welcome back. Let us talk about the Torah and the Torah portion for this evening, which, admittedly, is one of the ones that I've always found really interesting because it has a couple of unique features. For one, there are more mitzvot in this particular parsha than any other parsha in the Torah. And I actually saw somebody had counted them up and said that there are 74, basically, different commandments and bits of guidance in this one. And basically, well, let's see. First off, if you have your Bibles handy, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 21. We're almost at the, well, about the middle of chapter 21. This one begins in verse 10, where it says, "When you go forth, ki tetze le mil chama, when you go forth to battle or to war against your enemies, and Yahuwah delivers them into your hands." Then here comes some interesting stuff. Now, let me introduce it this way. This is something we've talked about several times of late. This portion, like so many of Scripture, is politically incorrect. There are a number of things in here that people sometimes just find downright offensive. How dare the Lord God, creator of the universe, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh himself, say things that are offensive to our modern sensibilities? And usually what I suggest is that if that's the case, then probably he knows human nature better than we do. He knows the way he made us better than we do. Maybe we would be well advised to go and read and see what he says. This one, too, this portion, kind of starts with marriage. Marriage is a consistent theme all through, and it ends with money. So make of that what you will. But it begins like this. When you go to battle, kitetse, and you see, and they're delivered into your hands, you carry some of them away captive, and then you see among the captives a woman of goodly form, a beautiful woman, and it's Ifat Tuar. And by the way, this terminology, this exact same Hebrew phrase, Ifat Tuar, is used to describe Rachel, for what that's worth. It's interesting. And it says here, if you have a desire for her, and you would take her to wife, then there is a series of things that are described that you have to do. Now, let's pause right there. Because oftentimes, at least when I refer to this, and others have, this portion of the Parsha is described as the idea of the war bride. And like I said, we start right off with something that is politically incorrect. I mean, the idea that people would take home a woman and then take one to wife. Well, of course, we know what the standard is in battle, and I have personally not ever been in war, so I cannot relate directly, although I've read histories, and I think a lot of folks have. And unfortunately, or I guess maybe fortunately for many of us, we don't quite have an understanding of what that's like. And suffice it to say that essentially, this is a pretty nice set of instructions that our Creator has given for us here, because for the most part, what almost all the other non-Torah observant armies in the world have done for most of human history is when they see a good-looking woman and they want her, or just regardless, they rape, pillage, murder, and kill. Emphasis on the rape part. So essentially, we're starting right off with something that may sound politically incorrect, but it begins with an understanding that you are not to do that. I see in the Midrash various comments about, oh, this is a concession to the Yetzer Hara, to the evil inclination. This is the Creator just kind of bending the rules a little bit here and saying it's okay. You know what, folks? I'm not buying that for a second. He knows us. He created us. But this is not so much as a concession as it is an indication. And it doesn't just tell us about the war bride either. It tells us a lot about human nature, and it tells us a whole lot about marriage as well, if we will take the lessons here. Because essentially what this is saying is not no. It's not saying that you cannot have a wife in this situation. What it is saying is you're to treat her the same kind of way that you're to treat any wife. She is to have the rights. She's to have the concessions of a wife. And by the way, it's going to be something which you're going to honor. It's a commitment. It's not just rape her and throw her away, as in fact most of the armies of the rest of the world have and in many cases continue to do. So right there, I guess when it comes to political correctness, when I see people, you know, railing against it and saying how horrible this is, how dare the creator of the universe specify something this barbaric? Well, it just tells me that the people that are saying such things haven't, A, ever studied scripture, or B, they don't have a clue about history. It's not barbaric at all. It's far from it. It is a respectful thing, and it is a an understanding of human nature, but it's also saying, look, you need to understand something about commitment and about covenant here. Well, so what is to happen with this war bride? By the way, one of the elements of this is, let's be really, really sure that you want to do this. You're to bring her home? She shaves her head, pares her nails. Well, that's going to make her attractive. Maybe that's part of the plan. She puts off the raiment of her captivity, the clothing. She remains in your house. She's to be given a full month to bewail her father and her mother. And after that, after this full month, if you still want to, you may go into her, lachak in the Hebrew there. That's the word take her, to be her husband, and she shall be your isha, your wife. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, you're not to do what the rest of the world does. You're to let her go. You don't sell her for money, because you are not to deal with her as a slave. You, in fact, have humbled her. Then the next verse goes on to say something else that is also politically incorrect, but certainly consistent with Scripture, with all the examples we've seen in the patriarchs. And by the way, there's one of them that's going to kind of resonate here too. It says, if a man has two wives... It's a given, obviously, that that's a possibility. If a man has two wives, and by the way, the terminology is kind of like when we see Yeshua using this reference to the parents. One is hated. I don't personally believe that he's really talking about hated, although I'm sure that there probably have been cases where a man doesn't have to have but one wife, and he can learn to hate one. In any case, in general, what this is really saying is he does not treat them equally. He treats one better than the other. Scripture makes that point very clear with respect to Jacob. It's not that he actually hates Leah. It's just that he didn't handle it well. He showed favoritism to Rachel, and the kids knew that too. So here we have the situation where if a man has two wives, he loves one more than the other. At any rate, they have both borne him children. And the firstborn son is the one that is not the favored wife. And by the way, this is the same situation we see with Reuben. There's a whole lot that could be said about this, but if we go into a whole lot of detail, then we run out of time to talk about the other 72 remaining mitzvot that we've got in this portion tonight. But suffice it to say, it does look a lot like what we see in the situation of Reuben. In the case of Reuben, by the way, it would appear that it was earned. His having been deposed as the firstborn wasn't merely because he loved Rachel more than he did Leah, although some have implied that that was the case, and I'm not going to take a position. It is evidently, and this is borne out when he talks to the boys as he's giving, or the men at this point, as he's giving the blessings on his deathbed. He tells Reuben why. Anyway, in this case, it says, in that day, when he basically lays out his inheritance, he is not to make the more beloved son the firstborn of the wife that he loves more, as opposed to the other firstborn of the other wife. He is instead to acknowledge the firstborn by giving him a double portion, which is the standard treatment for the firstborn. He is the first fruits of his strengths. The right of the firstborn is his. And by the way, that same terminology is used by Yaakov to Reuben when he is laying out the blessings for the 12 sons. Actually, if you count them all, there might even be more than that at that point in the book of Genesis. On to verse 18. Here's another one of these troublesome places. Now, let me pause for a second because, by the way, I'll take a look at the screen. Same thing goes for the locals here. If there are comments, questions, interjections, this is a particularly good Torah portion for that, so by all means do it. Same thing goes for the screen. Put the cues in front. I'll try to keep one eye on the screen anyway. We got one already? Go ahead.
I've never looked at it this way before, but in verse 14, if it shall be that if you are not pleased with her, that's probably before the end of the month, where before he's gone into her?
Doesn't say that. Well, I'm sure there would be people say, you know, you've had the milk, now you've bought the cow, or whatever the case may be. But it doesn't really say that, and you're right. There is some ambiguity on that point.
It must be after the
It certainly looks like after. Yeah. I got to go with that. I mean, there is, I can understand the other reading, but. There's all kinds of things that would count as humbling in there. So.
Out of our culture. So, good question.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I know that there will be at least two or three opinions to be had on the score. So, yeah, you're right. But over the years when I've looked at this, I can see that it can be read both ways. If I had to bet, and not that it matters, I still would tend to think that it probably is at the end of a month. You know, is it at the end of a year? At what point is it too late? We don't. Again, in order to make a statement beyond what it says here, we end up adding to or subtracting from. So I'm going to simply say, if I knew anybody that had a war bride, that would be up to that house to make that determination. But on the other hand, they're the ones that are going to have to stand before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and answer for it too. Okay. Anyway, verse 18 here. Any other? I don't see any other ones online. Okay. There are, again, there's several verses. We start off with like three or four different things right off the top here that people tend to focus on and say, oh, gee, see, look, this is why Jesus did away with all that stuff, which, of course, as we know, he said himself he wasn't going to do. And in spite of the fact that there have been lies taught, we've inherited lies from our fathers, as Jeremiah chapter 16 points out, that's not the case. This is the one that there was a famous letter to Ann Landers years ago. Oh, do you stone your son too? It says this, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son that won't hearken to the voice of his father or to the voice of his mother, in other words, he's 0 for 2, and though they chasten him, they still find that he will not hearken to him, then his father and mother to lay hold on him, bring him to the elders of the city, to the gate of his place, and they say to them, here's our son, he's stubborn, rebellious, he's a drunkard, he won't listen to us, he's a glutton. And the men of the city are to stone him with stones that he die. So you shall put away the evil from the midst of you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Now, I think, really, that's the key to this whole thing. Let me suggest a couple things. One, the Ann Landers story said, gee, do you stone your son? And the answer is, if you understand the history, and I'm not sure if it's probably Josephus and a lot of other places, but essentially, the tradition, the Midrash, the understanding for 1,000 years is that in all of history, this never happened. And it's colloquially referred to as the mitzvah that's never been done. Never had a son taken out and actually stoned. Now, I heard it taught this way. I think it was a cute way to teach it, so I stole it. I've been doing it ever since then. I have a friend who was Jewish, raised Jewish, heard this one, and he says, look, there may never have been anybody stoned, but I guarantee you, every little Jewish boy I knew was threatened with it. Okay? And it serves the purpose, and that's the point. All Israel shall hear and fear. You don't have to actually go out and stone a young man or an older man in order for the message to come through. You're not supposed to do this stuff. Listen to your father and your mother. And that's really the gist of it. That's kind of the spirit of Torah thing. We had that discussion about the spirit of Torah a couple weeks ago. It does not mean that simply because a commandment here, well, a man has two wives. That doesn't mean you have to. And it doesn't mean you're forbidden to. It just means simply that if this happens, then these things follow. So we read Torah, we see what it says, and we find out what is the case. If the stubborn, rebellious son gets to this point, then the situation can exist. But as a general rule, the idea is, because the punishment, the chastening is here, then thankfully it doesn't have to be executed. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, he's put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body is not to remain all night upon the tree, burying that same day. He that is hanged is a reproach unto Elohim. And don't defile the land that he's giving you for an inheritance. Very interesting. Suffice it to say, I guess, that when I see a lot of the references to the cross nowadays, I'm increasingly inclined to think that, given that we're having a reference to this, that's the instruction. It's about hanging on a tree. Not to be up there all night. We see that in the case of Yeshua. They made sure they got him down and in the tomb before it got dark. Chapter 22. Not seeing any other questions? Okay. And I'm not going to go through necessarily all the remaining 70 or so of these, but I'm going to hit at least as many of the high points as we can in trying to go through it all, because there are so many interesting themes, so many things about this that really fit together. And, of course, also we got a couple elements of this that are particularly key that I'm sure we're going to have some discussion about, even though we talk about it every year. You're not to see your brother's ox or his sheep driven away and hide yourself. If you see something your brother has lost, the general summary of these next couple of verses is, you are to bring them back to him. You have a positive obligation to restore that which is lost. It's not finders keepers, losers weeper. That's a lie. If your brother's not there, you don't even know who he is. You bring it home to your house. You take care of it till he requires it and you restore it to him. Same thing with his ass. You'll do that to his garment too, and every lost thing of your brother's. If you found it, you are not to hide yourself. You're to fess up, and you're to restore it to him. Same thing goes when you see his ox or his ass fallen down by the way. You're to help him lift them out. These are just basically a bunch of mitzvot that essentially say, look, here's how you build a strong community. Here's how you treat your brother. Here's how you honor him by taking care of the things that he has been blessed with. Lift them out again. There's more that could be said about this over the years. As you might suspect, there's a lot of midrash on, well, you know, how about if it's a sheep and we keep the sheep for a year? There's a lot of money keeping a sheep for a year. Well, essentially, and I don't have a problem with this, the midrashim go on to say, well, you know, if the animal can do work, then it's probably fair to let the animal work for you. You got to take care of it. You got to feed it. You're not supposed to put yourself into the poorhouse taking care of an animal. But on the other hand, you'll make sure that you restore it. You can't just put the sheep out in the yard and say, well, you know, if it finds water, great. You do have an obligation to help take care of it. A woman is not to wear that which pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. Whoever does these things is an abomination to Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. There's another one that's politically incorrect. Well, we don't teach that in grade schools anymore. No, those are called transgendered and LGBT, and we'll talk about that in the news tonight. That's about all I want to say for now. Well, we'll probably come back to it at least and mention it, because political correctness has made that a whole different thing. It's ironic that those things that the Creator calls abomination somehow or another get institutionalized in a nation which has forgotten him and doesn't even let him into their schools or courts or White Houses anymore. What did I want to mention about this? There has been lots of argument. I've seen division. Well, what is a woman that is wearing something that pertains to a man or vice versa? How about kilts? Right? How about pants? Any number of things that you'll see various churches will say, you know, women can't wear this, men can't wear this. I'm not going to get into the arguments about it. I do think it's a little bit silly to divide over some of it. But in general, what we can really recognize, I think the gist of what this is trying to say, because it does not specify, X is a woman's piece of clothing, Y is a man's piece of clothing. What it's saying is, within the norms of a society and a culture, there are things that literally are secondary sex characteristics that mark a woman. People see that in a manner of dress. They think, oh, that's a woman, or that's a guy. And in order to do something which looks deceptive is the issue. So it's not that pants per se or kilts per se are sinful. It's just a question of the abomination being, this is my understanding of it, so I'll make that clear, that which pertains to a man within the context of the people that are going to be looking at it. The one about the bird's nest is often called the leastest command in the Torah. And basically, if you find a bird's nest on the ground, and there's young ones or eggs, and there's a dam, a hen sitting upon the young, well, you're not to take them both. You're to let the mom go free. You can take the eggs. And it gives a blessing here. It's the same blessing we see for honoring your father and your mother, that it may be well with you and may prolong your days. Interesting. As you might suspect, if it's been called the least commandment in Torah, there's probably a whole lot of other stuff that goes with it. And it's kind of fun to read about. But again, a lot of that ends up being additions to and subtractions from. It says what it says. When you build a new house, here's a general concept that begins to lay out this idea of liability and of, what's the other word I'm looking for? Negligence. You are to put a parapet around your roof. In other words, a lot of times people will go up on the roof, and you're basically to have a railing so that somebody doesn't, in the dark, fall off and kill themselves. It's good sense, and it's something that Torah prescribes simply because it's a way of saying, look, think about these things. Do the things that will help your neighbor not to get hurt by accident on your property. The next few verses have to do with all kinds of concepts that basically boil down to mixing. Now, I'm not going to, again, add to or subtract from, but I do at least see that common theme here. You're not to sow your vineyard, for example, with two kinds of seed, lest the fullness of the seed that you've sown be forfeited with the increase of the vineyard. You're not to plow with an ox and an ass together. You remember the verse in the Brit Hadashah about being unequally yoked. You know, what you tend to do is plow circles in a situation like that. Not to wear mingled stuff, wool and linen together. By the way, there is an exception in the garments that the high priest wore. And, it's an interesting exception. And when he gives us the exception, we learn by comparing these things and saying, okay, there's a general rule. Here's a more specific rule for a certain case. And sometimes we can learn when we do the comparisons. You are to make twisted cords upon the four corners of your covering, your garment, wherewith you cover yourself. Is this another reference to the tzitzit? Certainly sounds like it. Elsewhere, but not here, we see that you're to have a blue thread when you do this as well. So this is another one of those commandments that shows up more than one places. Verse 13 takes us back to this concept of marriage. A man takes a wife. That word there again is lechak, to take a wife. He goes into her. He consummates the marriage, in other words, and he hates her. Or maybe she just doesn't fulfill whatever it was his dreams were. It's not clear. Does it have to be hate? I mean, those are the questions. He weighs up some wanton charges against her, brings an evil name upon her, and he says, look, I found this woman, and when I came into her, I found not in her the tokens of virginity. In other words, she wasn't as advertised. She was not a virgin on the wedding night. Then the father and her mother take forth the tokens of her virginity. This is a little bit delicately stated. Basically, we're talking about the linens upon which the consummation took place. And they go to the elders, and the father's to say to the elders, I gave my daughter unto this man, and he hates her. And now he has brought false charges against her. And here's the proof that he is not necessarily playing straight. They spread the garment before the elders of the city. They take the man, and they chastise him. They fine him. By the way, this is a pretty stiff fine. 100 shekels of silver is, haven't figured it out how many. That's probably the better part of a year's wages. I mean, this is a whole lot of money. And they give him to the father of the damsel because he has brought an evil name upon a virgin of Israel. Now, here's the other one. Now, this may, in fact, turn out to be even a worse penalty. He is to not be allowed to put her away, shalak her, much less divorce her, all the days of his life. She is to be his wife. It's kind of an interesting. So he brings a bad name upon this woman because he hates her, and the penalty is he pays a whole lot of money to those that he has wronged by bringing this Lashon Hara against her, and he is never allowed to put her away. On the other hand, if it's true, and she is in fact not what was supposed to be, then she is to be stoned because she's played the harlot in her father's house, put away evil from the midst of you. That's another one of those things people say, oh, well, we don't do that anymore. We don't care about any of that kind of stuff anymore because we don't even know what husbands and wives are anymore, I guess, is the bottom line. Verse 22, if a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, this is the very essence of the definition of adultery, then both of them shall die. The man that laid with the woman and with the woman, so you shall put away the evil from Israel. By the way, this is one of the several problems we just talked this week on the Torah Teachers Roundtable about the story of the woman allegedly caught in adultery that's brought before Yeshua. And there are lots of problems, but this one is one of them. Where's the man? If she was caught in the act, then, you know, don't you people know what the Torah says? What's that?
Isn't that what he wrote in the sand?
Well, we don't know what he wrote in the sand. I've heard about 37 different maybe 42 speculations on what he could have written in the sand. And he might have written this verse. He could have written all kinds of other verses. He might have just written, "Where's the woman?" You know, we don't know for sure. But yeah. If there is a woman, a damsel, and she is a virgin, but betrothed to a man. So the marriage has not yet been consummated, but literally she is his Isha at this point. What we're going to see here in these next few verses are two cases. The city wife and the country wife. Basically, the difference has to do with what we would now in jurisprudence in America call the presumption of innocence. In other words, it goes something like this. If there is this woman, she's betrothed, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her. Is it rape? Is it consensual? Doesn't really specify. Probably, the assumption is going to be, well, we'll see. Bring them both out to the gate of the city. Stone them with stones that they die. Why? The damsel, because she did not cry out. If it was rape, she would have cried out. In other words, is the presumption of the Torah. And she was in the city. So if she cried out in the city for crying out loud, somebody would have heard her. The man, of course, because he has committed this act. He's humbled his neighbor's wife. So you shall put away evil from the midst of you. But if the same thing happens, and this time the damsel is betrothed, is out in the field, out in the countryside, man takes hold of her, he lies with her, then he alone is guilty, he shall be put to death. Why? Because the presumption is, whether we know it or not, we're going to presume innocence on the part of the woman. There's no sin worthy of death, because we presume that if she did cry out, there would have been no one to hear her anyway. No one to save her. If a man finds a damsel, this time she is in fact a virgin, she is not betrothed to a future husband, and this time he lays with her, and it says lay hold on her too. Again, is this rape? Is it consensual? We see the same thing. There's a little bit of ambiguity in the story of Dinah in Yaakov's son. Was that in the men of Shechem, right? Was that a situation that was consensual? Well, what was Dinah doing out roaming around on her own? What? What did I say? Oh, okay. Yeah, that would have been the daughter. Yes. anyway, was it consensual? Was it not? It doesn't say. And in this case, that same ambiguity is there, because in general, the idea is that he should not be doing this. Now, I read this a little bit different nowadays. I didn't always read it this way. Again, this is my take on it. So understand that what it says is what it says. But when you put all these together, I tend to look at this modern concept of sex and the idea of virginity and of what constitutes marriage and so forth, and say when you put these pieces together and you connect the dots, what you find is that if there is consensual act here, if in other words there's a covenant that's been made, the woman has agreed, there's a marriage. Not only that, what it says is that the man is to give to the father a specific price, the bride price, in this case 50 shekels of silver, which again, that's half of what we were talking about before. That's a pretty stiff price. And she shall be his Isha, his wife, because he has humbled her. He should have at least gotten the father's permission, and he may not put her away all of his days. It's the second place in this chapter where we're seeing this idea that there will be no separation, no shalak, no, I'll come back to this concept in a second. No putting away, much less a divorce. Okay. Questions, comments on that? We'll come back because it's going to tie into some other things in a minute. And that's the key. I guess the other thing that I did want to mention on this before we go on is when we first read this, it says, "She shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He may not put her away." We see elsewhere that the father does, in fact, have a veto over this. So when I put the other pieces of Torah together, the father of a daughter, a virgin, living in his house, has the right, essentially, to say that her vows, on the day that he hears them, can be cast down. So I read that to say, in this case, too, the father is able, if he chooses to to say no. It just seems to be that the presumption is generally he might not, but he would have that ability. We see that elsewhere. Okay, got a question. Does 22 pertain to David and Bathsheba? 22 pertain to David. I doubt it, but let's see here. Oh, if a man be found lying with a woman, married to a husband. Well, in the case of David and Bathsheba, there was adultery that was committed. And they weren't caught, however. Well, we know that the situation is that there was a child that came out of that union, and it was the child that died. So David himself, and David, of course, did repent. It was a very famous case where Nathan comes to him. You are the man. It's a wonderful story, because the thing I have always admired about David, a man after God's own heart, David, when he was caught red-handed, or when he was basically confronted with the problem, he didn't deny it. He fell on his face and he fessed up. And you know, may we all be able to do even remotely as well as that. Wasn't perfect by any means, and that's, I think, comforting to some of us that aren't perfect either. All right, chapter 23. Man's not to take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's skirt. People that have crushed or maimed privy parts aren't to enter into the assembly. A mamzer, a bastard, is not to enter into the assembly, even under the 10th generation. Ammonite or Moabite, not to enter into the assembly, even under the 10th generation. Interesting, at some point, check out the genealogy of Ruth and of her son and her son's son. And it's a fascinating story. We're going to see in Ruth a couple of pieces out of this week's Torah portion that will all fit together. This one and another one, too. I'll leave that as an exercise for the listener. What other part of the story of Ruth shows up in this parsha? We haven't come to it yet. We will. Let's keep on going. We'll get there. Why? Because the Ammonite and the Moabite didn't meet you with bread and water when you came forth out of Egypt, because they hired against you Balaam, son of Beor, to try to curse you. And nevertheless, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh wouldn't listen to Balaam. He turned that curse into a blessing, because he loved you. You shall not to seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. But, then he turns around to verse 8, says, you're not to abhor an Edomite. He is, in fact, your brother. Yaakov I have loved, Esau I have hated. You're not to abhor the Egyptian either, because you were a stranger in his land. And this is interesting. I saw a midrash on it. Again, there's so many things to talk about tonight. I'm not going to belabor some of these. We'll just kind of go through them briefly. But essentially, the teaching of Moshe here, looking at some of these situations, is, you know what? There may be enmity. There may be strife between you and the Edomites. There may be strife today between Israel and Egypt. And the message that that this particular midrash drew out of this verse, and I think it's a valid one, is they may hate you, but you know what? That's no excuse for hating them back. There are times where the Creator says certain things, and we've just seen some examples about Ammonites and Moabites, and why. But you're not to abhor an Edomite, even if there is enmity in the other direction. The third generation of those that are born can enter into the assembly. When you go forth in your camp against your enemies, you're to keep yourself from every evil thing. It talks about various kinds of uncleanness, nocturnal emissions. People bathe themselves in the water, then the next day they can come back into the camp. You're to have a place outside the camp where you go make your potty runs. Carry a shovel. This is hygiene. But it's definitely something that is important. And believe me, if you're talking about running an army and putting a million people in the desert, this becomes literally a matter of life and death. You're to have a paddle among your weapons. Again, shovel is another way. When you sit down abroad, you dig with it. You come back and you cover it up when you're done. Because Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh walks in the middle of your camp too. And your camp should be set apart. Set that kind of stuff outside the camp. You're to not deliver a bondman that is escaped. You are not to deliver, in other words, to return an escaped slave back from his master. He's to dwell with you in the midst of you in the place that's chosen. Don't wrong him. There are to be no harlots among the daughters of Israel, nor are there to be sodomites among the sons of Israel. I look at that verse and I think about what I, you know, we don't have a network TV that we can flip on here. That's okay. But if we did, I suspect we would see verse 18 violated probably 37 times on any given network TV evening. You're not to bring the hire of a harlot at the price of a dog into the house. These are all abominations. Don't lend at interest to your brother. Interest of money or victuals or any other kinds of things that are normally lent at interest. Interestingly, you can lend to the goyim, the foreigner. Let's see, in this case it's not the goyim, it's Kree, and I don't remember that root. Okay, anyway, but you can lend to them. When you vow a vow, you better keep it. He will require it of you. If you don't, it is a sin in you. And by the way, it's not a problem if you realize that and forbear to vow. It's no sin. Yeshua said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. It's the same teaching. Just basically saying, look, do what you say you're going to do. And if you're not absolutely positive that you can do it, then better not to promise it at all. Whatever goes out of your lips, you shall observe and do, according as you have vowed freely unto Yahuwah Eloheka, that which you have promised with your mouth. This is important. If you promise it, do it. And I guess when I think about, you know, let's just say the halls of Congress and the White House and in most governor's mansions today, would that it be that people even had a remote clue about the oaths that they were taking and who they were taking them before? When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, interestingly, you can actually eat the grapes that are there. You're not allowed, however, to take a bag and harvest a bunch of them and take them home. The general concept, same thing with the standing corn and stuff. You can pluck ears. You can take, as we see the disciples of Yeshua doing, you take the grain, the standing grain, take a little bit, rub it in your hands, and eat it as you're walking through. But you don't come and bring the bag and take a major harvest. That's theft. So there's a difference, in other words, between, I guess you'd say, the things that are available, and we see the provision for the poor, corners of the field and so forth as well, all that make this point. There's a little bit extra in the fields. Don't sweat it. Chapter 24, verse 1 is one we want to take a couple minutes about. Oh, what was that about the dogs is the question on the screen. You're not to bring the price of a dog into the house of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh for any vow. These are an abomination. And, you know, I'll have to admit it. I should probably go back and do a study on that. I haven't done that. Every year I look at that and I kind of think, wonder what the price of a dog was and exactly what that's referring to. And honestly, I got to admit, I'm not sure. Okay. We're going to get to divorce and remarriage in just a second. Chapter 24. I think that's a question on the screen. Back to David. When David responded to Nathan's parable following the death of Uriah, he stated the man should pay fourfold for the dead man's lamb. It's interesting to note, okay, it's a comment. The scriptures explicitly record subsequently the untimely deaths of four of David's sons. The child born of adultery, Amnon at the hand of Absalom, Absalom at the hand of Joab, and finally Adonijah by the order of Solomon. Interesting. Okay, I hadn't seen that, but I guess it's... again, it fits with the other aspects of this. Be careful about the words from our mouths. Chapter 24. And let me pause here for a second. Now, a lot of you have probably heard me teach this, I don't know how many times at this point. I'm going to suggest a number of things, and I'll pull out the King James here too, and I'll turn to Matthew 5:32. Some of you, if you want, can pull that up, because among other things, is one of the places where I will suggest that the King James is not without errors, and there is in fact a major error in the translation of Matthew 5:32. We'll come back to that in a second, because it has to do with this understanding. And again, the other thing I mentioned up front, that this portion has a whole lot to do, starts with marriage, ends with money, and this idea of marriage and of covenant and of concepts that are associated with it, exclusivity, adultery, virginity, covenant again, and of vows, all literally follow through here. And we have gotten so much wrong. And no wonder marriage is such a mess. You know, people think that something that that is licensed by Big Brother constitutes a marriage. And if he says it's okay for a guy to lie with a guy as he does with a woman, well, that makes it lawful. No, it doesn't. It's still an abomination because the creator of the universe said so. And by the way, it does not require. There's nowhere in Scripture that we see a man of Yah going to ask any king or pope or potentate or civil official for permission to marry. Never happens. We do see a son asking his father, "Am I ready?" And we do see the would-be husband going to the father of the would-be bride and asking. In other words, we see that transfer of authority is consistent. It is the fathers that have the authority in here. And I guess it's interesting to me that it's the state that now tries to play God and take the role of the father in so many cases. So here's what chapter 24 says. We'll read what it says, and then we'll talk briefly, not at great length, because we could probably talk for 2 hours about the specifics of this. And by the way, if there's questions in particular that we don't have time to go into a lot of detail tonight, I'll probably, depending upon the flow tomorrow, I'll probably talk about it more tomorrow as well, because there is a lot that has been so twisted here that if we don't see how all of this stuff is consistent, absolutely consistent, line by line, precept by precept, then we miss the point. When a man takes a wife, it says, and has married her, and then it comes to pass, if she finds no favor in his eyes. All right, I'll just lay out some questions. Right there, there's a whole bunch of disputes, as you might figure, over the years. What does that mean? Did she burn the toast? Did she commit adultery, right? Is she not a virgin? Well, we've seen some of those things addressed specifically. The burning the toast, though, not. And that was let's just say it's been argued about ever since. He found something unseemly in her, though. So, what follows is a process. Several things, you can count them if you want, that he is to do. He is to write her a bill of divorcement. In the Hebrew, it's Sefer Keretuta. Literally, it's a writing of what is normally in modern Jewish circles called a get, a certificate. But it's a written evidence in his hand that he has put her away and released her from the vows. And then he does this. He puts it in her hand and he shalachs her. Ve shalacha. He sends her out of his house. So that word shalach literally is the word to send out or to put away. So right here, I'm going to suggest something that is an important distinction that gets missed, because we think, well, you know, the state giveth, the state taketh away. What is being talked about is a process, and this idea of putting away is only part of the process. The rest of the process consists of writing out the certificate, the get, and putting it in her hand. And that get, now this is Markology. In other words, this is my having connected the dots and looking at it. But if you go to the rest of Scripture and ask, okay, now it's going to tell us in two verses here that this woman can go become another man's Isha. She can go remarry. She has a lawful putting away and certificate of divorce. She can go remarry. And it says that very clearly. This latter husband, she may go out and she may become another man's Isha, another man's wife. So there's you know, when the church says can't happen, the answer is, well, excuse me, but the creator of the universe says it can. Who are we going to believe, you or him? So we can put that one away right quickly. The church that says that there is no such thing as divorce is a liar, and the truth is not in it, because Torah says that she can. And Yeshua, by the way, said he wasn't changing it. Oh, got a question. Is the wife ever able to write a writ of divorcement for any reason? Can she leave him? We'll come back to that, because that's two separate questions there. So far as Torah is concerned, no, the wife is not able to write out the get. Can she leave him? Well, we see in Paul's writings, it's 1 Corinthians 10, he says she is not to leave him, period. But if she does, then. So the fact that, remember, the fact that something is prohibited doesn't mean people won't do it, is kind of the consistent thing. In that case, when a wife leaves a husband and she has no certificate of divorce, she is still a wife. And Paul makes that clear in 1 Corinthians 10, too. She is to remain unmarried, or she is to return to him. And he is absolutely positively quoting Torah in that case. So divorcement for any reason was the question that was asked of Yeshua in Matthew. So we're going to come through several of these things, and I'll try to come back and kind of fill in the pieces of those questions as well. Because this is such an important issue, because this has been an issue that has been, A, twisted so much by the church, and B, bad people. You know, like Yeshua said, why is this even in here? Well, because of the hardness of your hearts. Y'all don't honor your covenants. You do bad things. Yod Heh Vav Heh, he honors covenant. He is showing you. He is a covenant keeper, period. We ought to do the same thing. We've just been told, you make a vow, you ought to keep it. It's that important. But what 24 is telling us here is, we are fallen human beings. We make these mistakes. There is provision for it. By the way, Malachi, it's often said, I hear it rendered in the Christian churches, I, the Lord God, hate divorce. That is not what Malachi 3:6 says. What it says is, I hate the putting away. And the point I want to make sure we understand is, putting away is not the same as divorce. Right? All horses are animals, but not all animals are horses. All divorce must include putting away. But not all putting away is a lawful, Torah-obedient divorce. And people were doing this in the time of Yeshua, which is part of, as we lead up to what Matthew 5 has to say here, we saw that men were putting away their wives, just putting them away and not giving them a certificate. That remains a problem to this day. Okay, let's go through what it says, though, again. Man takes a wife, he marries her. She finds no favor in his eyes. For whatever reason, there's a lot of questions could be asked there. He writes her a bill of divorcement, Sefer Keratuta. By the way, that word, that idea of the bill of divorcement only appears three times in the whole Tanakh. But this idea of putting away appears over and over and over and over again. He puts it in her hand, he sends her out of his house. He shalaks her. When she has departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's Isha. She may go and be another man's wife. And then it repeats, almost word for word, the very same set of procedures. If this other husband, he too hates her, he writes her a Sefer Keretuta. He puts it in her hand and he too shalaks her, sends her out of his house. Or maybe if he dies. Then it's going to tell us one other thing. She is not able to go back to that first husband, the one who sent her away, and give her this get. Now, it doesn't ever tell us why. It tells us the fact that after that she is defiled. All of this is abomination before Yahuwah. You are not to cause the land to sin, which he is giving you for an inheritance. So, you know, here's the speculation, right? Why can't she go back to the first husband? Now, I know probably most of you have heard cases where this has happened. Woman gets married, gets a divorce, goes marry somebody else, comes back to the first guy. And what the scriptures say is, not supposed to do that. By the way, Isaiah 50 and Jeremiah 3, we see a number of places where we see descriptions that that certainly shed some additional light on all of this. Okay, and Shoshana makes a very good point, and I'll just read the comment. When a man takes a woman who is not engaged, it says he has to marry her and never divorce her. But in today's world, that happens. Absolutely. What we have today, I have contended every time we go through this Torah portion, and indeed lots of others as well. We have a society that has gone so far away from Torah that we literally at the point where we call evil good and good evil. We license what he calls an abomination. We require various things. We forbid things like a man having two wives or all kinds of other stuff that he says is okay. Hey, you can have one gay husband, that's okay, just don't have two. You know, it's so far afield. And when it comes to covenant, forget covenant. We'll live together for a few years, have a few kids, then we'll decide if we want to go get legal. What difference does it make? Like that's going to make a difference? We don't understand that the covenant has already been made, and the important stuff has already happened. So, yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is I understand. And people come and they say, well, here's a problem. Okay, I have 47 wives. And, you know, my latest of the women that I've been sleeping with in the last month, well, they've got, you know, I don't know, they've been committing adultery for 20 years, or are they married, or all of the above? Can't really tell. We're that far gone. Can't get a get. I know that there are a lot of individual situations, and, you know, people always want to ask the question, well, what can I do now? What can I do now? I'm stuck. And by the way, the problem that is being referred to in the question here is called the Aguna problem. There are, and the historical example is, maybe some of you have heard this, in history, when a Hebrew man would go off to battle throughout, a thousand of years before Yeshua, they would oftentimes give their wives a get. They would literally write out a certificate of divorce and hand it to the wife. And the idea is, look, I expect you to be faithful while I'm gone, beloved. But on the other hand, if I don't come back, I don't want you to be stuck either. Because just as you've seen in Vietnam and in many other conflicts since, sometimes people are MIA. You know, is Soldier Bill dead? Did he just disappear? Did he run off? We don't know. And so the woman who basically has no husband and has been shellacked but does not have a get is called an aguna, and it has been a major problem. So what we're seeing here, and I guess I'll pause and mention this. As written, Torah is intended for our blessing. And we get into problems when we start cutting corners and not doing the things that it says to do, and doing the things that it says not to do, and then wonder why it seems like God is so unfair. And the answer is, He's not. If we would just listen, even when it comes to things like the war bride, His intention is to lay out things that are done for our blessing. It's about protection of women. And yet, because of the hardness of our hearts, and because of the lies, and because of the twistings, it can seem the opposite. But the problem is not His, the problem is ours, because we don't know. And let's see, Mark, I didn't know. I think there's a lot of questions on the screen, but I'm not sure if some of them are questions. Okay. Questions about Paul and what he's been teaching that's been mistranslated and mistaught. That is true. In most cases, though, with respect to Shaul or Paul, I will suggest that if we will read them properly, that they are consistent with Torah. There are very, very few cases, and in those cases where I see things that do look problematic, I suspect that the problem is in the translation rather than in what Paul's writing. Certainly in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and places where he talks about marriage, what he says is right on with respect to what the Torah says. And even that's true usually in the Greek, and as most of you know, I don't believe he wrote it in the Greek. I think he wrote it in Hebrew and it was translated. But in any case, even there, if you look and read it, it is consistent with Torah. Although I will agree, in the writings of our beloved brother Paul, as Peter says, many things that are difficult to understand and have often been twisted, as indeed they do the rest of scriptures, by those who are unlearned and untaught. Okay. So, what about widows? Can widows remarry? Yes, widows can remarry. And that's very clear. So the general idea, and I started to say this because there's so many places, so many questions that come up as you read through the if-thens and the processes here. What if this? What if this? What if this? There's an old saying, this applies to Torah as well, hard cases make bad law. In other words, if you only focus on the difficult places, a lot of times it tends to make people think things are worse than they are. Of course, the general idea is we're supposed to honor our covenants. And if we honor our covenants and understand that when a man makes a commitment to a woman, I will love you in the morning, whatever the commitment may be, there is a commitment there. And if it's consummated, I am firmly convinced, after having looked at this for a long time, that what we have is a marriage. And whether or not people recognize it or not, there's a whole lot of folks that, again, that are married and don't understand, and we see various problems. It is not the going before a justice of the peace that creates a marriage. Now, I have no problem. I know that there have been ceremonies throughout history. There are lots of traditions. Nothing wrong with traditions as long as they're consistent with Scripture. And I have no problem with the idea of witnesses and making a covenant public so that people can be held accountable, because sometimes they need that additional accountability. But the general concept here is just to understand, if we get to the place where we think, okay, I'm caught, can't do this, can't fix that, well, sometimes we can't. And what we then do is go back to Him. And, we're coming up on that time and season of Yom Kippur, where we need to address those things. People need to ask, hey, I've wronged person X, how can I make it right? And in general, if we look at Torah and try to see the bigger picture, we'll see all of those things that it says. You make wrong, you then try to make right. If you've stolen, if you have caused somebody to have loss, to suffer loss, you not only make them whole again, you add to it, and so forth. You bear false witness, you make it right. In the case of a guy bears false witness, claiming somebody's not a virgin, he made it right and it was expensive. So we can generally see the parameters anyway. All right, we got a long ways to go, and when a man takes a new wife, he's not to go out. He's basically to have a year to rejoice with her. The word is, he shall cheer his wife whom he has taken. And interestingly, in the Hebrew... Well, he's not to go to war. We see that differently. And here he's not to go out with the host, to war, or be charged with any business. He's to be free for his house for a year. So he takes basically a sabbatical, and he cheers up his wife. Sameach. Remember the word, right? Hag Sameach. It's a time of joy. Don't take a man's mill or upper millstone for pledge. Basically, you're taking something that might be important to his livelihood. If someone has been found stealing of his brethren, in other words, kidnapping, and that the word used here is nefesh, souls, you are to deal with him as a slave and sell him. That thief shall die. If he tries to sell somebody else into slavery, that thief shall die. Put away the evil from the midst of you. Observe the plague of leprosy. Remember what happened with Miriam. When you lend to your neighbor, you don't go to his house to fetch the pledge. If it's a poor man, don't keep it overnight. He might need that clothing or whatever he's pledged. It may be all he has. Don't oppress a hired servant. In the same day that you hire somebody, don't let the sun go down. Give them their wages. We've talked about that here not long ago. You try to make things good the same day. Fathers are not to be put to death for the children, nor shall children be put to death for the fathers. You die for your own sins. Don't pervert justice, do the stranger. Remember, you two were a bondman in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. When you reap the harvest of your field, and if you forget something, don't go back to fetch it. It's to be left. It's for the fatherless, the widow, and the stranger, so that Yahuwah may bless you in all the work of your hands. Same thing goes for your olive tree. You beat your olive tree, you do it once. You don't go back. That too is to be left so that people can come in and pick it. Now, the interesting thing, again, this is another aspect of something we see with Ruth, right? And we see that Boaz is making this provision. But unlike today, with this concept of welfare, what are the poor and the fatherless and the widow to do? They're to go out and harvest. They do have to go out and work for their food. They have to go get it themselves. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you're not to glean it after you. That, too, is to be left for the fatherless, the widow. Remember, you were a bondman in Egypt. And last few verses in chapter 25. If men come into controversy, it turns out that if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten before his face. But he is not to be given more than 40 stripes. Now, if you know the story, of course, of Yeshua, the things that have been taught by the rabbis for years, well, this is a firm limit, 40. Are you sure you counted correctly? Best be on the safe side, 39. So that's where this idea of don't exceed 39. Don't muzzle the ox when he treads out the grain. Animal's working, he's not to be muzzled. If he gets hungry while he's working, he can get some. Here comes one of the places that I mentioned a while ago, also going to show up in the story of Ruth. If brethren dwell together, okay, so right there, if we got some brothers that all dwell together, and one of them dies, he does not have an heir, he has left no child, what are we supposed to see? The wife of the dead is not to go out to a stranger, basically. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to him to wife. This is what got Onan in a world of hurt. And this is also kind of, sort of, although Boaz was not a brother and they didn't live together, we see this process being played out again. He is to perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. Okay, so what are we talking about here? This is often just called the law of the leveret or a leveret marriage. It's another place, by the way, just coincidentally, where it doesn't say, I remember having this discussion years ago in a Saturday morning Shabbat study session, and one of the wives of one of the Torah teachers piped up and said, well, obviously that's if he's not married, this law of the leveret. If he's married, then he can't. Well, excuse me, where does it say that in here? It doesn't. It says he's to do this duty. And if he doesn't do it, he's the one who had his shoe loosed. So it's another case where we carry some baggage sometimes, and we want to read our own understandings because we know better than God. But what he wrote is what he wrote. So the concept is, if a brother dies and he has no heir, well, who's going to inherit? Answer, it is the duty of the brother to take that wife. Now, I've heard all kinds of brothers listen to this one and go, whoa, my sister-in-law? No way, man. You know, check out, make sure you know who your brother's marrying, if that's going to be a, you know. I guess if that's a concern, you know. But in any case, the point here again, this is something that is foreign to us in so many respects because we've just plain lost track of so much of what the Torah says. These are things people are shocked by. They've never read it. And of course, the firstborn son to this marriage is to carry the name of the dead father. He literally is to inherit the father's portion. So, and this is, by the way, is what got Onan in trouble. He said, I don't want to raise up sons to my brother, or a son to my brother. And he was killed. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh struck him down for that. So that firstborn that she bears to succeed the name of the dead brother, so that his name is not blotted out of Israel. Now, they may very well have subsequent children. And that will happen. We see the same thing, by the way, happening with Judah. And in the story of Boaz, of course, we see this played out. Boaz is willing to take Ruth, a Moabitess, and that becomes a union that is blessed ultimately in the birth of King David and then later the Mashiach. All of which plays into the fact that it is a literal example of what this chapter 25, verse 6 is laying out. Okay, question. Is this only for women of childbearing age? I'm not sure if I understand the question, Jay. Because
if a woman has never had a child, but she's past childbearing age, is it still...
Oh, I see. We're talking a woman who's been married for decades, never had a child.
Right.
That's a good question. I guess it would be up to the brother.
Maybe she's not had...
And it may be that the brother was infertile. And so, yeah, I mean, I would... I guess the answer, if I was to answer, would say yeah. When you said childbearing age, I'm thinking if she was 9. And I'm thinking, no, you're thinking more like if she's 90. Because if she's 9, I was fixing to say, well, then she's probably not married yet. I don't see the point. But if she's like Sarai and she's 90, then, maybe so. Let's put it this way. If that situation was to come up and my brother who lived with me died, leaving a widow who was getting on up there, I'd certainly at least seriously consider it and think, you know, what's the proper thing to do here? The rest of the story goes on to say... Tony, you got a question? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say that with...
It's an extended family. He wasn't a brother. He was...
Right.
Yes, you're right. It was... And sorry, that didn't come through very well on the recording. So basically, we're talking an extension of the principle.
Right.
In other words, he wasn't a brother. He was not mandated in that situation this way. So, and he was a relative, and as you saw, he basically had to make sure that this other, who was nearer of kin, had first right of refusal, essentially, had he wanted Ruth. So that's where we see this process playing out. But you're right, he wasn't mandated to. And I think that's part of the blessing for Boaz. He was willing and able to do this for Ruth regardless. And there was great blessing that came from that. Well, I guess that's it. The kinsman redeemer concept we see playing out several times in Scripture. Like I said, similar with Judah. That's part of the reason why I think Judah said she is more righteous than I. And he realized that he had made a promise, and he had failed to deliver on the promise with the youngest of his sons. And what then literally came, and by the way, it was the progenitor of the line of kings in his case too, was from Judah. Through that union. Okay, so we know that if he doesn't do this, he goes before the elders of the city, and he has his shoe loosed. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that had his shoe loosed. Men strive together. The wife of one of them basically lays hands on the privy parts of the other man. It says, cut off her hand, your eye shall have no pity. That one, I'll admit, I've always looked at and thought, how many times did that happen? All right. But where I want to get is to, I guess, shoot them off if you're going to take care of the problem. Anyway, the last few verses in the chapter here, I think, are, we've joked about some of these things. Sometimes we have to do that simply because, again, we've moved so far from a lot of this stuff that it's almost a little bit shocking to us to realize just how far we've come. And in that respect, verses 13 through the end of the portion, we ought to have the same reaction to. But we don't. And the fact that we don't is almost shameful, I think. Verse 13 says, you're not to have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. What is it talking about? In other words, the way that you would if you were a flim-flam artist. What's the other word? The sting, what were they? A con man. And there's another term for it, too. A grifter. That's the word I was looking for. A grifter. You got multiple weights in your bag. All right, we're weighing out what you owe me here. Well, let's just slip the heavy one on, and then we'll get a little bit more. But when it comes to what I owe you, I got this little light one I slip it on. And every time if you're doing this kind of stuff, you're stealing from somebody. That's literally what it's talking about. Different weights, a great and a small. You're not to have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. Same thing. You're to have honest weights and measures. Verse 15 says that. A perfect and a just weight you shall have. A perfect and a just measure you shall have. To use dishonest weights and measures is theft. It is an abomination. You do this that your days may be long upon the land which Yahuwah Eloheka is giving to you. For all of those people who do such things, that do unrighteously, are an abomination unto Yahuwah. Then it even says this is kind of like what Amalek did, remember? He met you by the way. He took the hindmost. Wow. We're to hate Amalek. Amalek basically has a bad name throughout history. This is nasty stuff that's being talked about here. Now, those of you that have heard me talk for a little while know where I'm going. What is the United States almighty fiat dollar? It is a dishonest weight. Matter of fact, it's not a stinking weight at all. It was once defined by law as a weight of fine silver. Now it's nothing. It's an IOU nothing. It's not even a diverse weight. It is a lie from the get-go. It's an abomination. You can go to Book of Proverbs. Sometimes I'll list them out. I won't list them tonight. But there's no less than six places, and actually more than that if you expand the terminology a bit, where Solomon and the Proverbs define this exact thing as an abomination before God. He hates these things. And I look at the dollar, and I look at the things going on. We'll talk about the news in just a few minutes. And ask the question, why is the almighty dollar fixing to melt down like every other fiat currency in the history of the human race? Same reason, because it's an abomination. It will be destroyed. It will not last. And the Torah portion ends basically with this advice. Don't be like Amalek. Understand that all who do such things are an abomination. And I think probably when the final abomination upon all of it is, it says, and I have people tell me, oh, well, see, it's important. The coinage says, in God we trust. Like that makes it okay. We take this abomination and we say, in God we trust. Well, guess what? It ain't him. That's not the God we're trusting in. The God is mammon, because it's got nothing to do with the creator of the universe. Okay, Any other questions or comments? This was, like I said, quite a bit of stuff. We didn't even talk in detail about all of them. I know there's a lot there. I would simply encourage people to remember that there is no idle word in Torah. And even though we went fast through some of these things, all of this is important stuff. If we really want to understand marriage, understand covenant, read it, recognize that all the pieces fit together, and it's important. Is that a question?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. We have a local question.
On the floor.
And I didn't even talk about Matthew 5. But, okay.
When it talks about leaving part of the harvest in the corners of the field for the widows.
And the orphans and the...
Yeah. Now, this is something that can apply to us right here on the Mesa. Does it count widows that aren't of faith?
It doesn't say not to, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you the same answer, hopefully, consistently. What does it say? How do you read what it says? And I mean, I read so many of the midrashes, and they'll say, "Well, this is talking about a Jewish marriage. Where does it say that?" Okay, fine. There are Jews who want to be Torah observant. That's great. But on the other hand, there are those of us that may or may not think that we're Jewish or of the tribe of Judah or Benjamin even or Levi, but maybe we're of the lost tribes, maybe we're not. But if we want to be obedient to Yah, what do we do? Answer, honor your covenants, understand the commitments of marriage, understand what adultery is, do the right things, avoid the wrong things. And if you make mistakes, try to make things right. So yeah.
Help take care of widows.
And help take care of widows and leave a little bit of stuff around the corners. That's what I'm thinking. I'm not sure about your harvest. If about all that might get left is a potato in the corner, in my case. Okay, the question from the visitor was, for those of you that are online, I'm sorry, some of you couldn't probably hear that. Well, I'll try to edit that and make sure that it's audible as best I can. But in any case, the question had to do about, hey, doesn't that apply today? Can we do that? Well, again, we're not in the land. Always make sure we point that out. We're not in the land. However, I think it's a good thing to try to take these principles to heart. And if you can make provision for the widow, whether or not, the question was whether or not she's Torah observant, is she still a widow? And I would say, it looks to me like she's still a widow. Okay, another question?
And on that same note, if she's not a widow, but divorced, she doesn't have a covering.
That's true, too.
So she could be treated as the same way. How do you...
It's... So the question is, how about a woman who is divorced? You know, and by that I mean, you know, truly divorced. She does not have a covering. Can we take provision for those? And the answer, sure. Right? We do things for our brothers, too. The general concept of Torah is choose life, make provision, do the best things you can, and certainly it's great to help one another out. So I'd say the principle still stands. And whether we're in the land or not, whether she is a widow that's Torah observant or not, or whether she's a widow at all, we can help out in things. There may be kids that are not really orphans. Maybe their parents are both alive, but they've been abandoned. Well, are they kind of like orphans? Well, yeah, same principle. I promised I would do this, and we're running short of time, so I'll do it real quickly. And I'll really talk about this some more in detail tomorrow. Some of you have heard me address it anyway. Matthew 5 is the place where Yeshua says, this is the Sermon on the Mount, but I say unto you, this is the metaphor, the turn of phrase that he uses throughout the first part of this Sermon on the Mount. You have heard it said, but I tell you. And in this case here, he's talking about this idea of putting away and of divorce. It says, it hath been said, I'm reading verbatim first from the King James, whosoever shall put away his wife, and that word translated correctly, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. And I will suggest to you that is a pitifully bad translation. Yeah, because it uses the word correctly there. He said the word shalak in the Hebrew. I am firmly convinced. There's a Greek word, apuolo and apuolos. And basically, it is used several times. But the King James translators translated it once as put away and the exact same word as divorced in the same verse. And that's the part that's wrong. Okay, what it should have said, and by the way, other translations do fix this. So for those that say the King James is the unadulterated Word of God as Jesus spoke it in the King James English, it's not true. There's an error here. Whosoever shall marry her that is put away commits adultery. Why? We've already talked about it. Because the woman who is put away, only put away, and does not have a get, is still married. That's what he's talking about. And by the way, when he puts away a wife, when a man puts a wife out of his house and does not give her a get, what is he doing? He's exactly right. Yeshua says he causes her to commit adultery. Why? She's been turned out. She has no covering. Guess what she is likely to go do? Go find another man. You, mister, are the cause of her committing adultery. So, again, it is a teaching which, if you understand the Hebrew and read what Deuteronomy 24 says and what Yeshua is teaching, then it is absolutely consistent. But if you read instead what some of the translators have made a muck of it, then it's no longer clear, and it has resulted in all kinds of bad doctrine over the centuries, saying, oh, see, you married a divorced woman, you adulterer, you. That's not what the scriptures say. All right. Any other questions, comments? Yes, for those of you online, we have someone with the ISR scriptures, for example, who says that rendering's not so great either in this case. Problematic? Okay, I've seen several. New King James, and the New King James actually fixed it. NIV, I think the NIV was a mess if I'm remembering right, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so there's... The point is, with all of these things, if we will read them, and you know, when it comes to drawing doctrine, I'd like to see the Hebrew. There is a Matthew version of the Hebrew, and the Matthew version of the Hebrew generally gets it right. There's George Howard's Matthew. Is it the original? There's Shem Tov's Matthew that people will talk about. Probably none of them are original, but they very well do seem to predate the Greek versions of the Matthew. Okay. So the point again is just understand that Yeshua said he is not changing the Torah. And if you see a translation where he seems to change the Torah, it is not Yod Heh Vav Heh, the author of Scripture, who's at fault.